I'm not sure. I think so.
What else did you hear?
Nothing else. The shots cut it off, you know. He started yelling about Allah, and then the shot drowned the rest out.
You mean like Allah Akbar? Is that what he yelled?
I don't know. I just heard the Allah part.
Could you tell if he had an accent?
An accent? I couldn't tell. I only heard the one thing.
British? Arabic?
I really couldn't tell. I was too far away, and I only heard the one word.
Bosch thought about this for a few moments. He remembered that he had read about the cockpit recordings from the 9/11 attacks. The terrorists called out, Allah Akbar, God is greatest, at the last moment. Did one of Stanley Kent's killers do the same? Again, he knew he had to be careful and thorough. Much of the investigation could hinge on the one word Mitford thought he had heard from the Overlook. Jesse, what did Detective Ferris tell you about this case before he put you in this room? The witness shrugged.
He didn't tell me anything, really.
He didn't tell you what we think we're looking at here, or what direction the case may be going?
No, none of that.
Bosch looked at him for a few moments. Okay, Jesse, he finally said. What happened next?
After the shots, somebody ran from the clearing to the cars. There was a streetlight out there, and I saw him. He got into one of the cars, and he backed it up close to the Porsche. Then he popped the trunk and got out. The Porsche's trunk was already open.
Where was the other man while he did this? Mitford looked confused.
I guess he was dead.
No, I mean the second bad guy. There were two bad guys and one victim, Jesse. Three cars, remember? Bosch held up three fingers as a visual aid.
I only saw one bad guy, Mitford said. The shooter. Somebody else stayed in the car that was behind the Porsche, but he never got out.
He just stayed in that other car the whole time?
That's right. In fact, right after the shooting, that car made a U-turn and drove away.
And the driver never got out the whole time he was at the Overlook?
Not while I was looking.
Bosch thought about this for a moment. What Mitford had described indicated a real division of labor between the two suspects. This mirrored the description of events that Alicia Kent had given earlier. One man questioning her and then translating and giving orders to the second. Bosch assumed it was the English speaker who had remained in the car at the Overlook. Okay, he finally said. Go back to the story, Jesse. You said that right after the shooting, one guy drives away while the other backs up closer to the Porsche and pops the trunk. Then what happened?
He got out and took something from the Porsche and put it in the other car's trunk. It was really heavy, and he had a hard time with it. It looked like it had handles on the sides because of the way he was holding it.
Bosch knew that he was describing the pig used to transport radioactive materials. Then what?
He just got back in the car and drove off. He left the trunk open on the Porsche.
And you saw nobody else?
Nobody else, I swear.
Describe the man you did see.
I can't really describe him. He was wearing a sweatshirt with the hood up. I never really saw his face or anything. I think that under the hood he was wearing a ski mask, too.
Why do you think that? Mitford shrugged again.
I don't know. It just seemed that way to me. I might be wrong.
Was he big? Was he small?
I think he was average, maybe a little short.
What did he look like? Bosch had to try again. It was important. But Mitford shook his head.
I couldn't see him, he insisted. I'm pretty sure he had a mask.
Bosch didn't give up. White, black, Middle Eastern?
I couldn't tell. He had the hood and the mask, and I was so far away.
Think about the hands, Jesse. You said there were handles on the thing he transferred from one car to the other. Could you see his hands? What color were his hands?
Mitford thought for a moment, and his eyes brightened.
No, he wore gloves. I remember the gloves because they were those real big kind, like the guys wear who work on the trains back in Halifax. Heavy duty with the big cuffs, so they don't get burned.
Bosch nodded. He had been fishing for one thing, but got something else, protective gloves. He wondered if they were gloves specifically designed for handling radioactive material.
He realized that he had forgotten to ask Alicia Kent if the men who entered her house had worn gloves. He hoped that Rachel Walling had covered all the details again when she was left with her. Bosch paused there. Sometimes the silences are the most uneasy moments for a witness. They start to fill in the blanks. But Mitford said nothing. After a long moment, Bosch continued. Okay, we had two cars up there besides the Porsche. Describe the car that backed up to the Porsche.
I can't, really. I know what Porsches look like, but I couldn't tell about the other cars. Both were a lot bigger, like with four doors.
Let's talk about the one in front of the Porsche. Was it a sedan?
I don't know the brand.
No, a sedan is a type of car, not a brand. Four doors, trunk, like a police car.
Yes, like that.
Bosch thought about Alicia Kent's description of her missing car. Do you know what a Chrysler 300 looks like?
No.
What color was the car you saw?
I don't know for sure, but it was dark, black or dark blue.
What about the other car? The one that was behind the Porsche?
Same thing, a dark sedan. It was different from the one in front. Maybe a little bit smaller, eh? But I don't know what kind it was. Sorry.
The boy frowned as though it was a personal failing that he didn't know the makes and models of cars. It's all right, Jesse. You're doing fine, Bosch said. You've been very helpful. Do you think if I showed you photos of various sedans, you could pick out the cars?
No, I didn't see them enough. The lighting on the street wasn't good, and I was too far away.
Bosch nodded, but was disappointed. He considered things for a moment. Mitford's story matched up with information provided by Alicia Kent. The two intruders to the Kent house had to have had transportation to get there. One would have taken the original vehicle, while the other took Alicia Kent's Chrysler to transport the cesium with. It seemed like the obvious thing. His thoughts prompted a new question for Mitford. Which way did the second car go when he drove off?
He also made a U-turn and drove down the hill.
And that was it?
That was it.
What did you do then?
Me? Nothing. I just stayed where I was.
Why?
I was scared. I was pretty sure I had just seen some guy get murdered.
You didn't go check on him to see if he was alive and needed help? Mitford looked away from Bosch and shook his head.
No, I was afraid. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Jesse. You don't have to worry about that. He was already dead. He was dead before he hit the ground. But what I'm curious about is why you stayed in hiding for so long. Why didn't you go down the hill? Why didn't you call 911? Mitford raised his hands and dropped them on the table.
I don't know. I was afraid, I guess. I followed the map up the hill, so that was the only way I knew back. I would have had to walk right by there, and I thought, what if the cops come while I'm walking right there? I could get blamed. And I thought, if it was like the mafia or something that did it, and they found out I had seen everything, then I'd be killed or something.
Bosch nodded. I think you watch too much American TV up there in Canada. You don't have to worry. We'll take care of you. How old are you, Jesse?
20.
So what were you doing at Madonna's house? Isn't she a little old for you?
No, it wasn't like that. It was for my mother.
You were stalking her for your mother?
I'm not a stalker. I just wanted to get my mother her autograph or see if she had a picture or something I could have. I wanted to send something back to my mom, and I don't have anything. You know, just to show her I'm okay. I thought if I told her I'd met Madonna, then I wouldn't feel like such a, you know. I grew up listening to Madonna because my mom listens to her stuff. I just thought it would be kind of cool to send her something. Her birthday's coming up, and I didn't have anything.
Why'd you come to L.A., Jesse?
I don't know. It just seemed like the place to go. I was hoping I could get in a band or something. But it's looking like most people come here with their band already. I don't have one.
Bosch thought Mitford had adopted the pose of the wandering troubadour, but there had been no guitar or other mobile instrument with his backpack in the squad room. Are you a musician or a singer?
I play the guitar, but I had to pawn it a few days ago. I'll get it back.
Where are you staying?
I don't really have a place right now. I was going to sleep up in the hills last night. I guess it's the real answer to why I didn't leave after I saw what happened to that guy up there. I really didn't have any place to go.
Bosch understood. Jesse Mitford was no different from 1,000 others who got off the bus every month or thumbed it into town. More dreams than plans or currency. More hope than cunning, skill, or intelligence. Not all of those who fail to make it stalk those who do. But the one thing they all share is that desperate edge. And some never lose it, even after their names are put up in lights and they buy houses on top of the hills.
"Let's take a break here, Jesse," Bosch said. "I need to make a few phone calls and then we'll probably need to go over it all again. You cool with that? I'll also see about maybe getting you a hotel room or something."
Mitford nodded. "Think about the cars and the guy you saw, Jesse. We need you to remember more details."
"I'm trying, but I..."
He didn't finish, and Bosch left him there. In the hallway, Bosch switched on the air conditioning in the interview room and set it at 64. It would soon cool off in the room, and instead of sweating, Mitford would start to get cold, though coming from Canada, maybe not. After he chilled for a while, Bosch would take another run at him and see if anything new came out. He checked his watch. It was almost 5 a.m., and the case meeting the feds were organizing was not for another 4 hours. There was a lot to do, but he still had some time to work with Mitford. The first round had been productive. There was no reason for him not to think there was more to be gained by a second go at it. Out in the squad room, Bosch found Ignacio Ferres working at his desk. He was turned in his seat and was typing on his laptop on a slide-out table. Bosch noticed that Mitford's property had been replaced on the desk by other evidence bags and file folders. It was everything from SID that the case had spawned so far on the two crime scenes.
"Harry, sorry I didn't get back in there to watch," Ferres said. "Anything new from the kid?"
"We're getting there. I'm just taking a break."
Ferres was 30 years old and had an athlete's body. On his desk was the trophy awarded him for being his academy class's top achiever in physical conditioning and testing. He was also handsome, with mocha skin and short-cropped hair. He had piercing green eyes. Bosch stepped over to his own desk to use the phone. He was going to wake up Lieutenant Gamble one more time to give him another update.
"You tracked the Vic's gun yet?" he asked Ferres.
"Yeah, I got it off the ATF computer. He bought a .22 caliber belly gun 6 months ago, Smith & Wesson."
Bosch nodded. "A .22 fits," he said. "No exit wounds."
"Bullets check in, but they don't check out."
Ferres delivered the line like a television commercial huckster and laughed at his own joke. Bosch thought about what was lying beneath the humor. Stanley Kent had been warned that his profession made him vulnerable. His response was to purchase a gun for protection. And now Bosch was betting that the gun he'd bought had been used against him, had been used to kill him by a terrorist who called out the name of Allah as he pulled the trigger. What a world it was, Bosch thought, when someone could draw the courage to pull the trigger on another man by calling out to his God.
"Not a good way to go," Ferres said.
Bosch looked across the two desks at him.
"Let me tell you something," he said. "There are no good ways to go."
Chapter 9. Bosch went to the captain's office to refill his coffee mug. When he reached into his pocket for another buck for the basket, he came out with Brenner's card, and it reminded him of Brenner's request to be updated on the possibility of a witness. But Bosch had just finished updating Lieutenant Gandel on what the young Canadian said he had seen and heard at the Overlook, and together they had decided to keep Mitford under wraps for the time being. Until at least the 9 a.m. meeting, when it would be put-up-or-shut-up time with the feds. If the federal powers that be were going to keep the LAPD involved in the investigation, it would become clear at that meeting. Then it would be quid pro quo time. Bosch would share the witness's story in exchange for a share of the investigation. Meantime, Gandalf said he would send another update through the department's chain of command. With the latest revelation of the word Allah cropping up in the investigation, it was incumbent upon him to make sure the growing gravity of the case was communicated upward. With his mug full, he went back to his desk and started going through the evidence collected from the murder scene and the house where Alicia Kent had been held while her husband did the bidding of her captors. He was already aware of most of what had been found at the murder scene. He started removing Stanley Kent's personal belongings from the evidence bags and examining them. At this stage, they had been processed by forensics, and it was okay to handle them. The first item was the physicist's BlackBerry. Bosch was not adept in a digital world and readily acknowledged this. He had mastered his own cell phone, but it was a basic model that made and received calls, stored numbers in a directory, and did nothing else, as far as he knew. This meant that he was quite lost as he tried to manipulate the higher evolution device. "Harry, you need help with that?" Bosch looked up and saw Ferris smiling at him. Bosch was embarrassed by his lack of technological skill, but not to the point where he wouldn't accept help. That would turn his personal flaw into something worse. "You know how to work this?"
"Sure."
"It has email, right?"
"It should."
Bosch had to get up to hand the phone across both of their desks. "About 6 o'clock yesterday, Kent was sent an email that was marked urgent from his wife. It had the photo in it of her tied up on their bed. I want you to find it and see if there is a way you can somehow print it out with the photo. I want to look at the photo again, but bigger than on that little screen." As Bosch had been speaking, Ferris had already been working the BlackBerry.
"No problem," he said. "What I can do is just forward the email to my own email account here. Then I'll open it up and print it out."
Ferris started using his thumbs to type on the phone's tiny keyboard. It looked like some sort of child's toy to Bosch, like the ones he had seen kids use on planes. He didn't understand why people were always typing feverishly on their phones. He was sure it was some sort of warning, a sign of the decline of civilization or humanity, but he couldn't put his finger on the right explanation for what he felt. The digital world was always billed as a great advancement, but he remained skeptical.
"Okay, I found it and sent it," Ferris said. "It'll probably come through in a couple minutes, and I will print it. What else?"
"Does that show what calls he made and what calls came in?"
Ferris didn't answer. He manipulated the controls on the phone. "How far back do you want to go?" he asked.
"For now, how about going back till about noon yesterday?" Bosch replied.
"Okay, I'm on the screen. You want me to show you how to use this thing, or do you want me to just give you the numbers?"
Bosch got up and came around the row of desks so he could look over his partner's shoulder at the phone's small screen. "Just give me an overview for now, and we'll run the whole picture down later," he said. "If you tried to teach me, we'd be here forever."
Ferris nodded and smiled. "Well," he said, "if he made or received a call to or from a number that was in his address book, it is listed by the name associated with the number in the address book."
"Got it."
"It shows a lot of calls to and from the office and various hospitals and address book names, probably doctors he worked with, all through the afternoon. 3 calls are marked Barry, and I am assuming that was his partner. I looked up the state corporate records online, and K&K Medical Physicists is owned by Kent and someone named Barry Kelber."
Bosch nodded. "Yeah," he said. "That reminds me that we have to talk to the partner first thing this morning." Bosch leaned across Ferris's desk to reach the notepad on his own desk. He then wrote the name Barry Kelber down, while Ferris was continuing to scroll through the cell phone's call log.
"Now here we are after 6, and he starts alternately calling his home and his wife's cell phone. I get the feeling that these weren't answered because he's got 10 calls logged in 3 minutes. He was calling and calling, and these were all made after he received that urgent email from his wife's account."
Bosch saw the picture beginning to fill in a little bit. Kent had a routine day on the job, handled a lot of calls to and from people in places familiar to him, and then got the email from his wife's account. He saw the photo attached and started calling home. She didn't answer, which only alarmed him further. Finally, he went out and did what the email instructed him to do. But for all his efforts and following of orders, they still killed him on the Overlook. "So what went wrong?" he asked out loud.
"What do you mean, Harry?"
"Up at the Overlook. I still don't understand why they killed him. He did what they wanted. He turned over the stuff. What went wrong?"
"I don't know. Maybe they killed him because he saw one of their faces.
The witness says the shooter was wearing a mask."
"Well, then maybe nothing went wrong. Maybe the plan was to kill him all along. They made that silencer, remember? And the way the guy yells out, 'Allah,' doesn't make it sound like something went wrong. Makes it sound like part of a plan."
Bosch nodded. "Then if that was the plan, why kill him and not her? Why leave a witness?"
"I don't know, Harry. But don't those hardcore Muslims have a rule about hurting women? Like it keeps them out of nirvana or heaven or whatever they call it?"
Bosch didn't answer the question because he didn't know about the cultural practices his partner had crudely referred to. But the question underlined for him how out of his element he was on the case. He was used to chasing killers motivated by greed or lust or any one of the big seven sins. Religious extremism wasn't often on the list. Ferris put the BlackBerry down and turned back to his computer. Like many detectives, he preferred to use his own laptop because the computers provided by the department were old and slow, and most of them carried more viruses than a Hollywood Boulevard hooker. He saved what he had been working on and opened up his email screen. The email forwarded from Kent's account was there. Ferras opened the email and whistled when he saw the embedded photograph of Alicia Kent, naked and tied up on the bed.
"Yeah, that would do it," he said,
meaning that he understood why Kent had turned over the cesium. Ferras had been married for less than a year and had a baby on the way. Bosch was just starting to get to know his young partner, but knew already that he was deeply in love with his wife. Under the glass top of his desk, Ferras had a collage of photos of his bride. Under the glass on his side of the workstation, Bosch had photos of murder victims, whose killers he was still looking for.
"Make me a printout of that," Bosch said. "Blow it up if you can, and go ahead and keep playing with that phone. See what else you can find."
Bosch went back to his side of the workstation and sat down. Ferras enlarged and printed out the email and photo on a color printer located at the back of the squad room. He went over and retrieved it, and then brought it to Bosch. Bosch already had his reading glasses on, but from a desk drawer he pulled a rectangular magnifying glass he'd bought when he noticed that his prescription was no longer strong enough for the close-up work. He never used the magnifying glass when the squad room was crowded with detectives. He didn't want to give the others something to ridicule him with, either in jest or not. He put the printout down on his desk and leaned over it with the magnifier. He first studied the bindings that held the woman's limbs behind her torso. The intruders had used six snap ties, placing one loop around each wrist and ankle, then one to link the ankles, and the last one to link the wrist loops to the loop connecting the ankles. It seemed like an overly complicated way to bind the woman's extremities. It was not the way Bosch would have done it if he were trying to quickly hogtie a perhaps struggling woman. He would have used fewer bindings and made the work easier and quicker. He wasn't sure what this meant, or if it meant anything at all. Perhaps Alicia Kent hadn't struggled at all, and in return for her cooperation, her captors used the extra links in order to make the time she was left bound on the bed less difficult. It seemed to Bosch that the way she had been bound meant that her arms and legs were not pulled behind her as far as they could have been. Still, remembering the bruising on Alicia Kent's wrists, he realized that no matter what, the time she had spent hogtied naked on the bed had not been easy. He decided that the only thing he knew for sure from studying the photo was that he needed to talk with Alicia Kent again and go over what had happened in more exacting detail. On a fresh page of his notebook, he wrote down his questions about the bindings. He planned to use the rest of the page to add more questions in preparation for an eventual follow-up interview with her. Nothing else came to mind during his study of the photograph. When he was finished, he put the magnifier aside and started skimming through the forensics reports from the murder scene. Nothing grabbed his attention there either, and he quickly moved on to the reports and evidence from the Kent house. Because he and Brenner had quickly left the house for St. Agatha's, Bosch had not been there when the SID tech searched for evidence left behind by the intruders. He was anxious to see what, if anything, had been found. But there was only one evidence bag, and it contained the black plastic snap ties that had been used to bind Alicia Kent's wrists and ankles, and that Rachel Walling had cut in order to free her. "Wait a minute," Bosch said, holding up the clear plastic bag. "Is this the only evidence they bagged at the Kent house?" Ferras looked up. "It's the only bag they gave me. Did you check the evidence log? It should be in there. Maybe they're still processing some stuff." Bosch looked through the documents Ferras had obtained until he found the forensic evidence log. Every item removed from a crime scene by the technicians was always entered on the log. It helped track the chain of evidence. He found the log and noticed that it included several items removed by technicians from the Kent house, most of them tiny hair and fiber specimens. This was to be expected, though there was no telling if any of the specimens was related to the suspects. But in all his years working cases, Bosch had yet to come across the immaculate crime scene. Plain and simple, it was a basic law of nature that when a crime takes place, it always leaves its mark, no matter how small, on the environment. There is always a transfer. It is just a matter of finding it. On the list, each snap tie had been individually entered, and these were followed by numerous hair and fiber specimens extracted from locations ranging from the master bedroom carpet to the sink trap in the guest bathroom. The mouse pad from the office computer was on the list, as well as a Nikon camera's lens cap, which had been found beneath the bed in the master bedroom. The last entry on the list was the most interesting to Bosch. The evidence was simply described as a cigarette ash. Bosch could not think what value as evidence a cigarette ash could be. "Is anybody still up there in SID from the Kent house search?" he asked Ferras. "There was a half hour ago," Ferras answered. "Buzz Yates and the Leighton's woman, whose name I always forget." Bosch picked up the phone and called the SID office.
"Scientific Investigation Division. Yates."
"Buzz, just the guy I wanted to talk to."
"Who's this?"
"Harry Bosch. On the search of the Kent house, tell me about this cigarette ash you collected."
"Oh, yeah, that was a cigarette that had burned down to just the ash. The FBI agent who was there asked me to collect it."
"Where was it?"
"She found it on top of the toilet tank in the guest bedroom. Like somebody had put their smoke down while they took a leak and then forgot about it. It burned all the way through and then out."
"So it was just ashes when she found it?"
"Right, a gray caterpillar. But she wanted us to collect it for her. She said their lab might be able to do something with—"
"Wait a minute, Buzz. You gave her the evidence?"
"Well, sort of, yeah. She—"
"What do you mean, sort of? You either did or you didn't. Did you give Agent Walling the cigarette ashes you collected from my crime scene?"
"Yes," Yates conceded. "But not without a lot of discussion and assurances, Harry. She said the Bureau of Science Lab could analyze the ashes and determine the type of tobacco, which would then allow them to determine country of origin. We can't do anything like that, Harry. We can't even touch that. She said it would be important to the investigation because they might be dealing with terrorists from outside the country. So I went along with it. She told me that once she worked an arson case where they found a single ash from the cigarette that lit the fire. They were able to tell what brand, and that tied it to a specific suspect."
And you believed her?
Well, yeah, I believed her.
So you gave her my evidence. Bosch said it in a resigned tone.
Harry, it's not your evidence. We all work and play on the same team, don't we?
Yeah, Buzz, we do.
Bosch hung up the phone and cursed. Ferras asked him what was wrong, but Bosch waved the question away.
Just typical bureau bullshit.
Harry, did you get any sleep at all before the call-out?
Bosch looked across the desks at his partner. He knew exactly where Ferras was headed with that question.
No, Bosch answered. I was awake. But lack of sleep has nothing to do with my frustration with the FBI. I've been doing this for more years than you've been alive. I know how to handle sleep deprivation. He held his mug of coffee up.
Cheers,
he said.
It's still not good, partner, Ferras responded. Your ass is going to be dragging in a while. Don't worry about me.
Okay, Harry.
Bosch went back to thoughts about the cigarette ash.
What about photos? He asked Ferras.
Did you pick up photos from the Kent house?
Yeah, they're here somewhere.
Ferras looked through the files on his desk and came up with the folder containing the photos and passed it across. Bosch looked through them and found three shots from the guest bathroom. A full shot, an angled shot of the toilet that showed the line of ash on the tank lid, and a close-up of the gray caterpillar, as Buzz Yeats had called it. He spread the three shots out and used his magnifier once again to study them. In the close-up shot of the ash, the photographer had put a 6-inch ruler down on the tank lid to give the shot scale. The ash was almost 2 inches long, almost a full cigarette.
See anything yet, Sherlock? Ferras asked.
Bosch looked up at him. His partner was smiling. Bosch didn't smile back, deciding that now he couldn't even use the magnifying glass in front of his own partner without getting ripped.
Not yet, Watson, he said.
He thought that might keep Ferras quiet. Nobody wanted to be Watson.
Bosch studied the shot of the toilet and noted the seat had been left up. The indication was that a male had used the bathroom to urinate. The cigarette ash would further indicate that it had been one of the two intruders. Bosch looked at the wall above the toilet. There was a small framed photograph of a winter scene. The leafless trees and steel gray sky made Bosch think of New York or somewhere else in the East. The photo prompted Bosch to remember a case he had closed a year ago while he was still in the open unsolved unit. He picked up the phone and called SID again. When Yates answered, Bosch asked for the person who checked the Kent house for latent fingerprints.
Hold on, Yates said. Apparently still annoyed with Bosch from the earlier phone call, Yates took his time getting the latent tech to the phone.
Bosch ended up holding for about 4 minutes, using his glass to go over the photos from the Kent house the whole time.
"This is Wittig,"
a voice finally said. Bosch knew her from prior cases.
"Andrea, it's Harry Bosch. I want to ask you about the Kent house.
What do you need?
Did you laser the guest bathroom?"
"Of course. Where they found the ash and the seat was up, yes, I did that."
"Anything?"
"No, nothing. It was wiped."
"How about the wall above the toilet?"
"Yes, I checked there, too. There was nothing."
"That's all I wanted to know. Thanks, Andrea."
"Have a good one."
Bosch hung up and looked at the photo of the ash. Something about it bugged him, but he wasn't sure what.
"Harry, what were you asking about the wall over the toilet?"
Bosch looked at Ferras. Part of the reason the young detective was partnered with Bosch was so that the experienced detective could mentor the inexperienced detective. Bosch decided to put the Sherlock Holmes crack aside and tell him the story. "About 30 years ago, there was a case in Wilshire. This woman and her dog found drowned in her bathtub. The whole place had been wiped clean, but the lid was left up on the toilet. That told them they were looking for a man. The toilet had been wiped, but on the wall up behind it, they found a palm print.
The guy had taken a leak and leaned on the wall while doing it. By measuring the height of the palm, they were able to figure out the guy's height. They also knew that he was left-handed.
How?
Because the print on the wall was a right palm. They figured a guy holds his tool with his preferred hand while taking a leak. Ferris nodded in agreement.
So they matched the palm to a suspect?
Yeah, but only after 30 years.
We cleared it last year in Open Unsolved. Not a lot of palms in the databanks back then. My partner and I came across the case and sent the palm through the box. We got a hit. We traced the guy to 10,000 palms in the desert and went out there to get him. He pulled a gun and killed himself before we could make the arrest.
Wow.
Yeah. I always thought it was weird, you know.
What, him killing himself?
No, not that. I thought it was kind of weird that we traced his palm to 10,000 palms.
Oh, yeah, ironic.
So you didn't get a chance to talk to him?
Not really.
But we were sure it was him, and I sort of took his killing himself in front of us as an admission of guilt.
No, yeah, of course. I just mean I would have liked to talk to the guy and ask him why he killed the dog.
That's all.
Bosch stared at his partner for a moment. I think if we had talked, we would have been more interested in why he killed the woman.
Yeah, I know. I was just wondering, why the dog, you know?
I think he thought the dog might be able to identify him. Like the dog knew him and would react in his presence. He didn't want to risk it.
Ferris nodded like he accepted the explanation.
Bosch had just made it up. The question about the dog had never come up during the investigation.
Ferris went back to his work, and Bosch leaned back in his chair and considered things about the case at hand. At the moment, it was a jumble of thoughts and questions, and once again, most prominent in his mind was the basic question of why Stanley Kent was killed. Alicia Kent said the two men who held her captive had worn ski masks. Jesse Mitford said he thought the man he saw kill Kent on the overlook was wearing a ski mask. To Bosch, this begged the questions, why shoot Stanley Kent if he couldn't even identify you? And why wear the mask if the plan all along was to kill him? He supposed that wearing the mask could have been a ploy to falsely reassure Kent and to make him cooperative, but that conclusion didn't feel right to him either. Once more, he put the questions aside, deciding that he didn't have enough information yet to properly go at them. He drank some coffee and got ready to take another shot at Jesse Mitford in the interview room. But first he pulled out his phone. He still had Rachel Walling's number from the Echo Park case. He had decided never to delete it. He pushed the button and called the number, preparing for it to have been disconnected by her. The number was still good, but when he heard her voice, it was a recording telling him to leave a message after the beep.
"It's Harry Bosch," he said. "I need to talk to you about things, and I want my cigarette ashes back. That crime scene was mine." He hung up. He knew the message would annoy her, maybe even make her mad. He knew that he was inextricably heading toward a confrontation with Rachel and the Bureau that probably wasn't necessary and could easily be avoided. But Bosch couldn't bring himself to roll over. Not even for Rachel and the memory of what they once had. Not even for the hope of a future with her that he still carried like a number in a cell phone's heart.
Chapter 10. Bosch and Ferris stepped out the front door of the Mark Twain Hotel and surveyed the morning. The light was just beginning to enter the sky. The marine layer was coming in gray and thick and was deepening the shadows in the streets. It made it look like a city of ghosts, and that was fine with Bosch. It matched his outlook.
"You think he'll stay put?" Ferris asked.
Bosch shrugged.
"He's got no place else to go," he said.
They had just checked their witness into the hotel under the alias Stephen King. Jesse Mitford had turned into a valuable asset. He was Bosch's ace in the hole.
Though he had not been able to provide a description of the man who shot Stanley Kent and took the cesium, Mitford had been able to give the investigators a clear understanding of what had transpired at the Mulholland Overlook. He would also be useful if the investigation ever led to an arrest and trial. His story could be used as the narrative of the crime. A prosecutor could use him to connect the dots for the jury, and that made him valuable, whether or not he could ID the shooter. After Bosch had consulted with Lieutenant Gandil, it was decided that they shouldn't lose track of the young drifter. Gandil approved a hotel voucher that would keep Mitford in the Mark Twain for 4 days. By then, things would be clearer in regard to which way the case was going to go. Bosch and Ferris got into the Crown Victoria that Ferris had earlier checked out of the car shed and headed down Wilcox to Sunset. Bosch was behind the wheel. At the light, he got out his cell phone. He hadn't heard back from Rachel Walling, so he called the number her partner had given him. Brenner answered right away, and Bosch proceeded cautiously. "Just checking in," he said. "We still on for the meeting at 9? Bosch wanted to make sure he was still part of the investigation before updating Brenner on anything. Yes. Yes, we're still on for the meeting, but it's been pushed back."
"Till when?"
"I think it's 10 now. We'll let you know." The answer didn't make it sound like the meeting with the locals was a done deal. He decided to press Brenner. "Where will it be, at tactical?" Bosch knew from working with Walling before that the tactical unit was off campus in a secret location. He wanted to see if Brenner would slip. "No, in the federal building downtown, 14th floor. Just ask for the TIU meeting." "How helpful was the witness?" Bosch decided to hold his cards close until he had a better idea of his standing. He saw the shooting from a distance. Then he saw the transfer. He said one man did it all, killed Stanley Kent, and then moved the pig from the Porsche to the back of another vehicle. The other guy waited in another car and just watched.
"You get any plates from him?"
"No, no plates. Mrs. Kent's car was probably the one used to make the transfer. That way there would be no cesium trace in their own car."
"What about the suspect he did see?"
"Like I said, he couldn't ID him. He was still wearing a ski mask. Other than that, nada." There was a pause before Brenner responded.
"Too bad," he said. "What did you do with him?"
"The kid, we just dropped him off."
"Where does he live?"
"Halifax, Canada."
"Bosch, you know what I mean."
Bosch noticed the change in tone, that and the use of his last name. He didn't think Brenner was casually asking about Jesse Mitford's exact location.
"He's got no local address," he replied. "He's a drifter. We just dropped him off at the Denny's on Sunset. That's where he wanted to go. We gave him a 20 to cover breakfast."
Bosch felt Ferris staring at him as he lied.
"Can you hold a second, Harry?" Brenner said. "I got another call coming in here. It might be Washington."
Back to first names, Bosch noted.
"Sure, Jack, but I can just go."
"No, hold on." Bosch heard the line go to music, and he looked over at Ferris. His partner started to speak.
"Why'd you tell him we—"
Bosch held a finger to his lips, and Ferris stopped. "Just hold it a second," Bosch said. Half a minute went by while Bosch waited. A saxophone version of What a Wonderful World started to play on the phone. Bosch had always loved the line about the dark, sacred night. The light finally changed, and Bosch turned onto Sunset. Then Brenner came back on the line.
"Harry, sorry about that. That was Washington. As you can imagine, they're all over this thing."
Bosch decided to draw things out into the open.
"What's new on your end?"
"Not a lot. Homeland is sending a fleet of choppers with equipment that can track a radiation trail. They'll start up at the Overlook and try to pick up a signature specific to cesium. But the reality is it's got to come out of the pig before they'll pick up a signal. Meantime, we're organizing the status meeting so that we can make sure everybody's on the same page."
"That's all the Big G has accomplished?"
"Well, we're just getting organized. I told you how it would be. Alphabet soup."
"Right, you called it pandemonium. The feds are good at that."
"Now, I'm not sure I said all of that, but there's always a learning curve.
I think after the meeting, we'll be hitting this thing on all cylinders. Bosch now knew for sure that things had changed. Brenner's defensive response told him the conversation was either being taped or overheard by others. "It's still a few hours till the meeting," Brenner said. "What's your next move, Harry?" Bosch hesitated, but not for long. "My next move is to go back up to the house and talk to Mrs. Kent again. I have some follow-up. Then we'll go over to the South Tower at Cedars. Kent's office is there, and we need to see it and talk to his partner." There was no response. Bosch was coming up on the Denny's on Sunset. He pulled into the lot and parked. Through the windows, he could see that the 24-hour restaurant was largely deserted. "You still there, Jack?"
Yeah, Harry, I'm here. I should tell you that it probably won't be necessary. You going back to the house and then by Kent's office."
Bosch shook his head. "I knew it," he thought. "You've already scooped everybody up, haven't you?"
"Wasn't my call. Anyway, from what I hear, the office was clean and we have Kent's partner in here being questioned right now. We brought Mrs. Kent in as a kind of a precautionary thing. We're still talking to her, too."
"Not your call. Then whose call was it? Rachel's?"
"I'm not going to get into that, Harry."
Bosch killed the car's engine and thought about how to respond. "Well, then, maybe my partner and I should head downtown to TIU, he finally said. "This is still a homicide investigation, and last I heard, I was still working it." There was a long thread of silence before Brenner responded.
"Look, detective, the case is taking on larger dimensions. You have been invited to the status meeting, you and your partner, and at that time you will be updated on what Mr. Kelber has had to say and a few other things. If Mr. Kelber is still here with us, I will do my best to get you in to speak with him, and with Mrs. Kent, too. But to be clear, the priority here is not the homicide. The priority is not finding out who killed Stanley Kent. The priority is finding the cesium, and we're now almost 10 hours behind." Bosch nodded.
"I have a feeling that if you find the killer, you find the cesium," he said.
"That may be so," Brenner responded. "But the experience is that this material is moved very quickly, hand to hand. It takes an investigation with a lot of velocity. That's what we're engaged in now, building velocity. We don't want to be slowed down
by the local yokels.
You know what I mean."
"Sure. I'll see you at 10, Agent Brenner."
Bosch closed his phone and started to get out. As he and Ferris crossed the lot to the restaurant's doors, his partner barraged him with questions.
"Why did you lie to him about the wit, Harry? What's going on? What are we doing here?"
Bosch held his hands up in a calming motion. "Hold on, Ignacio. Just hold on. Let's sit down and have some coffee and maybe something to eat, and I'll tell you what is going on."
They almost had their pick of the place. Bosch went to a booth in a corner that would allow them a clear view of the front door. The waitress came over quickly. She was an old battle axe, with her steel-gray hair in a tight bun. Working graveyard at Denny's in Hollywood had leached the life out of her eyes.
"Harry, it's been a long time," she said.
"Hey, Peggy. I guess it's been a while since I've had to chase a case through the night."
"Well, welcome back. What can I get you and your much younger partner?"
Bosch ignored the dig. He ordered coffee, toast, and eggs over medium well. Ferris ordered an egg white omelet and a latte. When the waitress smirked and told him that neither could be accomplished, he settled for scrambled eggs and a regular coffee. As soon as the waitress left them alone, Bosch answered Ferris's questions.
"We're being cut out," he said. "That's what's going on here."
"Are you sure? How do you know?"
"Because they've already scooped up our victim's wife and partner, and I can guarantee you that they are not going to let us talk to them."
"Harry, did they say that? Did they tell you that we couldn't talk to them? There's a lot at stake here, and I think you're being a little paranoid. You're jumping to..."
"Am I? Well, wait and see, partner. Watch and learn.
We're still going to the meeting at 9, aren't we?"
"Supposedly. Except now it's at 10. And it will probably be a dog and pony show, just for us. They're not going to tell us anything. They're going to sweet-talk us and brush us aside.
Thanks a lot, fellas. We'll take it from here.
Well, fuck that. This is a homicide, and nobody, not even the FBI, brushes me off a case.
Have a little faith, Harry.
I have faith in myself. That's it. I've been on this road before. I know where it goes. On the one hand, who cares? Let them run with the case. But on the other hand, I care. I can't trust them to do it right. They want the cesium. I want the bastards who terrorized Stanley Kent for 2 hours and then forced him down on his knees and put 2 slugs in the back of his head.
This is national security, Harry. This is different. There's a greater good here. You know, the good of the order.
It sounded to Bosch like Ferris was quoting from an academy textbook or the code of some sort of secret society. He didn't care. He had his own code. The good of the order starts with that guy lying dead on the overlook. If we forget about him, then we can forget about everything else. Nervous about debating his partner, Ferris had picked up the salt shaker and was manipulating it in his hand, spilling salt on the table.
Nobody's forgetting, Harry. It's about priorities. I'm sure that when things shake out during the meeting, they will share any information relating to the homicide.
Bosch grew frustrated. He was trying to teach the kid something, but the kid wasn't listening.
Let me tell you something about sharing with the feds, Bosch said. When it comes to sharing information, the FBI eats like an elephant and shits like a mouse. I mean, don't you get it? There will be no meeting. They put that out there so we would stay in line until 9 and now 10, all the while thinking we're still part of the team. But then we'll show up there, and they'll delay it again, and then they'll delay it again, until they finally trot out with some organizational chart that's supposed to make us feel like we're part of everything, when the reality is we're part of nothing, and they've run out the back door.
Ferris nodded as though he was taking the advice to heart, but then he spoke from somewhere else.
I still don't think we should have lied to them about the witness. He might be very valuable to them. Something he told us might fit with something they know about already. What's the harm in telling them where he is? Maybe they take a shot at him and get something we didn't. Who knows?
Bosch emphatically shook his head. No fucking way. Not yet. The wit is ours, and we don't give him up. We trade him for access and information, or we keep him for ourselves. The waitress brought their plates and looked from the salt spilled on the table to Ferris and then Bosch.
I know he's young, Harry, but can't you teach him some manners?
I'm trying, Peggy, but these young people don't want to learn.
I hear you.
She left the table and Bosch immediately dug into his food, holding a fork in one hand and a piece of toast in the other. He was starved and had a feeling they'd be on the move soon. When they would next have time for a meal was anybody's guess. He was halfway through his eggs when he saw 4 men in dark suits walk in with unmistakable federal purpose in their strides. Wordlessly, they split into 2s and started walking through the restaurant. There were less than a dozen diners in the place, most of them strippers and their boyfriend pimps heading home from 4 o'clock clubs, Hollywood nightcrawlers, fueling the engine before putting it to sleep. Bosch calmly continued to eat and watched the men in suits stop at each table, show credentials, and ask for IDs. Ferris was too busy splashing hot sauce on his eggs to notice what was happening. Bosch got his attention and nodded toward the agents. Most of the people scattered among the tables were too tired or buzzed to do anything but comply with the demands to show identification. One young woman with a Z shaved into the side of her head started giving one pair of agents some lip, but she was a woman, and they were looking for a man, so they ignored her and waited patiently for her boyfriend with the matching Z to show some ID. Finally, a pair of agents came to the table in the corner. Their creds identified them as FBI agents Ronald Lundy and John Parkin. They ignored Bosch because he was too old, and asked Ferris for his ID.
"Who are you looking for?" Bosch asked.
"That's government business, sir. We just need to check some IDs."
Ferris opened his badge wallet. On one side it had his photo and police ID, and on the other side his detective's badge. It seemed to freeze the 2 agents.
"It's funny," Bosch said. "If you're looking at IDs, that means you have a name.
but I never gave Agent Brenner the witness's name. Makes me wonder. You guys over there in tactical intelligence don't happen to have a bug in our computer, or maybe our squad room, do you? Lundy, the one obviously in charge of the pickup detail, looked squarely at Bosch. His eyes were as gray as gravel. "And you are?" he asked. "You want to see my ID, too? I haven't passed for a 20-year-old in a long time, but I'll take it as a compliment." He pulled out his badge wallet and handed it to Lundy unopened. The agent opened it and examined the contents very closely. He took his time. "Hieronymus Bosch," he said, reading the name on the ID. "Wasn't there some sick creep of a painter named that? Or have I got it confused with one of the bottom feeders I've read about in the overnights?" Bosch smiled back at him. "Some people consider the painter a master of the Renaissance period," he said. Lundy dropped the badge wallet on Bosch's plate. Bosch hadn't finished his eggs yet, but luckily the yolks were overcooked. "I don't know what the game is here, Bosch. Where's Jesse Mitford?" Bosch picked up his badge wallet and used his napkin to clean egg debris off it. He took his time, put the wallet away, and then he looked back up at Lundy. "Who's Jesse Mitford?" Lundy leaned down and put both hands on the table. "You know damn well who he is, and we need to take him in." Bosch nodded as though he understood the situation perfectly. "We can talk about Mitford and everything else at the meeting at 10, right after I interview Kent's partner and his wife." Lundy smiled in a way that carried no friendliness or humor. "You know something, pal? You're going to need a Renaissance period yourself when this is all over." Bosch smiled again. "See you at the meeting, Agent Lundy. In the meantime, we're eating. Can you go bother somebody else?" Bosch picked up his knife and started spreading strawberry jam from a little plastic container on his last piece of toast. Lundy straightened up and pointed at Bosch's chest. "You better be careful, Bosch." With that, he turned and headed toward the door. He signaled to the other team of agents and pointed toward the exit. Bosch watched them go. "Thanks for the heads up," he said. Chapter 11. The sun was still below the ridgeline, but dawn had a full grip on the sky. In daylight, the Mulholland Overlook showed no sign of the violence of the night before. Even the debris usually left behind at a crime scene, rubber gloves, coffee cups, and yellow tape, had somehow been cleaned up or maybe had blown away. It was as if Stanley Kent had not been shot to death. His body never left on the promontory with the jetliner view of the city below. Bosch had investigated hundreds of murders during his time with the badge. He never got over how quickly the city seemed to heal itself, at least outwardly, and move on, to act as though nothing had ever happened. Bosch kicked at the soft orange ground and watched the dirt drop over the edge into the brush below. He made a decision and headed back toward the car. Ferris watched him go. "What are you going to do?" Ferris asked. "I'm going in. If you're coming, get in the car." Ferris hesitated and then trotted after Bosch. They got back in the Crown Vic and drove over to Arrowhead Drive. Bosch knew that the feds had Alicia Kent, but he still had the key ring from her husband's Porsche. The Fed car they had spotted when they had driven by 10 minutes earlier was still parked in front of the Kent house. Bosch pulled into the driveway, got out, and headed with purpose to the front door. He ignored the car in the street, even when he heard its door open. He managed to find the right key and get it into the lock before they were hit with a voice from behind. "FBI, hold it right there." Bosch put his hand on the knob. "Do not open that door." Bosch turned and looked at the man approaching on the front walkway. He knew that whoever was assigned to watch the house would be the lowest man on the tactical intelligence totem pole, a screw-up, or an agent with baggage. He knew he could use this to his advantage. "LAPD Homicide Special," he said. "We're just going to finish up in here." "No, you're not,"
the agent said. The Bureau has taken over jurisdiction of this investigation and will be handling everything from here on out.
Sorry, man, I didn't get the memo, Bosch said. If you'll excuse us.
He turned back to the door. Do not open that door, the agent said again. This is a national security investigation now. You can check with your superiors.
Bosch shook his head. You may have superiors, I have supervisors.
Whatever, you're not going into the house.
Harry, Ferris said, maybe we...
Bosch waved a hand and cut him off. He turned back to the agent.
Let me see some ID, he said.
The agent put an exasperated look on his face and dug out his creds. He flipped them open and held them out. Bosch was ready. He grabbed the agent by the wrist and pivoted. The agent's body came forward and passed him, and Bosch used a forearm to press him face first against the door. He pulled his hand, still clutching his credentials, behind his back. The agent started struggling and protesting, but it was too late. Bosch leaned his shoulder into him to keep him against the door and slipped his free hand under the man's jacket. He found and jerked the handcuffs off the agent's belt and started cuffing him up.
"Harry, what are you doing?" Ferris yelled.
"I told you nobody's pushing us aside." Once he had the agent's hands cuffed behind him, he grabbed